Hello and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. Today we're looking at international bond markets and currency markets, and offering expert advice we're joined by Jack McIntyre, a leading fund manager at Brandywine Asset Management. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Guthridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to have a macro conversation with Jack McIntyre, the lead manager on the Brandywine Global Fixed Income Fund, and I think the conversation is going to take us, in several different directions. But I think we want to get Brandywine's view on developed market inflation, how bond markets may react to the changing prints, and what that means for various currencies, particularly looking at the dollar. And of course, what that may mean for emerging markets. So, Jack, first of all, thank you very much for coming here, flying in from the States exclusively for this podcast interview.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to do it.
So, as I said, let's start the conversation with inflation. It does seem as though there are a lot of ingredients in place in the developed world, particularly the US, for inflation to get running. Yet it hasn't really started firing. So we want to talk about where you think inflation's going. But of course, as a bond fund manager, we want to know whether you think there's a mispricing in markets relative to those inflation expectations.
Right. So you're right. As you pointed out, being a bond manager, inflation is our nemesis. So we got to figure out where is inflation going, what's priced in to bonds, and we're global. So it's not just about inflation in the developed world, but we have to look at it in the developing world as well. So what's going on? Okay, let's start with the U.S. and we'll broaden out. So, you know, the U.S. clearly is firing on all cylinders right now. And, you know, you can thank the tax reform for bringing forward some demand. Yet, you know, we haven't seen inflation get out of control. And all you have to do is look at the shape of the yield curve in the U.S. And it's telling us that the Fed isn't behind the curve, that if inflation expectations are well anchored. So then you have to think about inflation cyclically versus some secular influences and disinflationary influences. So cyclically, as you would expect, economies doing well, supply and demand dynamics, wages increase. So you'd expect to see inflation move a little bit higher. I don't think treasuries, and when we look at nominal yields relative to actual inflation, real yields are still pretty low. So it's not as though treasuries are pricing in enough cyclical inflation. But having said that, I don't think we're going to see a big bear market in treasuries because I don't think we're going to see inflation get out of hand. I think the secular disinflationary influences are going to keep a lid on that cyclical inflation. So just as a reminder, what are those sort of secular disinflationary influences? Well, okay, so globalization, and I won't spend time on that because we know, you know, that's resulting in the shift towards populism and governments. But what else away from that? Technology. So two ways I think about it. One is automation. So as wages move higher, we're going to see more money being invested in the corporate sector into automation, robotics. Robotics pricing has come down. It's available more for even smaller businesses now. That's great because that's going to enhance productivity. It's probably going to keep a little bit of a lid on wages. But then we also think about, and this one I think needs to be even more emphasized, even more, the competitive backdrop introduced by automation. So again, you can kind of think of it as the Amazon effect. I just think that competitive forces are going to keep a lid on inflation. So we know corporate and businesses are seeing input cost increase, and wages are certainly one of those. But up to this point, they have not been able to automatically pass on those higher input costs. Why is that? Well, because it's an extremely competitive backdrop. You just don't know where competition is going to come from going forward. Again, I think at some point they will be able to do that, but it won't generate the type of inflation that we're used to. And then just another key part of the secular disinflation is just the amount of debt in the developed world. So we've taken on a huge amount of debt to get this growth profile that we have. That means as rates move higher, the cost of servicing that debt increases significantly. All you have to do is look at Japan. Rates are low, yet interest costs are becoming an increasingly bigger part of the federal government's budget. If rates move higher in the U.S., well, all of a sudden, we're going to have to take money that would have been used to invest in infrastructure, something more productive, to increasing the servicing cost of the treasury holder. So that's money going to Japan, China, et cetera. So those are the real factors, and you can obviously throw in demographics. But that's why I think there's a lid on inflation in the developed world.
And so, I mean, I would have thought the consensus is wedded to the view that the Fed, and I guess the Fed communications don't really suggest anything to the different to the contrary to this, is that the Fed's going to raise interest rates once a quarter, really up until the middle, if not until the end of 2019. I mean, I sort of, the time horizons between cyclical shorter term inflationary pressures versus these longer term themes that keep a lid on inflation. I mean, does that mean that you are more dovish essentially than the consensus, or can you still conform to the idea that Fed's got to go once a quarter for the next year?
Yeah, I'm not once a quarter for the next year. I mean, remember the Fed up until recently has kind of got this wrong too. I mean, they've historically been a little bit more hawkish than reality is, but no, clearly environment's changed. So yeah, obviously December is done, and then you start looking, I think, at three next year. So yeah, I can see that unfolding, but again, I want to look at the yield curve as a barometer, because you've seen some Fed officials say they don't want to tighten policy rates where they preemptively invert the yield curve. But you've also seen some doves become a little bit more hawkish. So I think the key for us, and more importantly for the Fed, is what are the implications of the tax reform? I mean, are we going to, in Q4, maybe hit sort of peak growth in the U.S., and then growth might sort to start to mean revert? I struggle to think that growth is going to be 4%, you know, going through next year. It's going to go, I suspect, 4% to 3%, 2.5%. And that's an environment where, yeah, the Fed can go slow. I think along these lines, probably the most important data points that we have to watch is U.S. inflation. Because if inflation starts to percolate and move higher, yeah, then the Fed's going to be more aggressive in tightening. And then that's how business cycles have historically ended. But if inflation remains tame, and I'm a little bit more in that camp, then the Fed can go slow. And Powell's told us that. I mean, to me, and maybe it's because he's not a PhD, he's not an economist, I think he understands that there's a qualitative part of this, and you've got to be kind of pragmatic. And so I don't think the Fed is going to over tighten. They're going to be like the rest of us, and they're going to analyze the data as it comes out.
And is it your Fed view then that drives your position on the dollar, trying to marry up what exactly that Fed and inflation outlook is, and how that feeds into your dollar view?
And it's a great question, because, and this is the interesting thing with currencies, and we've been managing currencies for decades, that certain factors can change influences on currencies. And what I mean by that is that sometimes rate differentials matter, and that's relative monetary policy. And we saw that earlier this year, and the dollar strengthened because, hey, the Fed actually told us that they were going to get a little bit more aggressive in terms of tightening, and the dollar rallied. But that wasn't the story in 2017. The Fed, remember, tightened three times in 2017, yet the U.S. dollar was weak. And again, why is that? Because the currency market was focused on relative growth, not sort of relative monetary policy. I think we're starting to see something like that unfold now. We've just talked about the currency markets. They know the U.S. economy is doing extremely well right now. That's not new information. Yet the dollar hasn't been rallying of late. Okay, so we've got to be a little bit selective. Actually, the dollar's been strengthening versus the yen, a little bit versus the euro. But versus the emerging market currencies, it actually hasn't been rallying. And I think that's because you're actually starting to see at the margins, I'd say, either a little bit better growth or less negative growth in some of these economies. So I think we're going to kind of transition to that relative growth. And again, you also have to look at what's getting discounted in prices. And we know EM has struggled this year, and those prices have discounted a pretty negative economic scenario. I think it's probably a little too negative versus what ultimately is going to be reality. So, yeah, I think the dollar is poised to weaken a little bit here. And then just since we're talking about the dollar, you got to bring into the analysis politics. We've got the midterm in the U.S. coming up here very quickly. And I think, and again, when we look at the dollar, there's a relationship between the U.S. dollar and the president's approval rating. And you would think with the U.S. economy doing it as well as it is, the approval rating would be significantly higher and the dollar would be even stronger. That's not the case. The president's approval rating has been pretty stagnant, certainly relative to the U.S. economy. I extrapolate that. That probably means that the Democrats are going to do well in the midterms. That has dollar implications because one of the things that's gotten priced into the dollar isn't just the tax reform package sort of 1.0. There's talk of tax reform 2.0, 3.0. If the Democrats take control of the House, that's not going to happen. And I think the U.S. dollar has to go through an adjustment. We're going to get gridlock. Maybe there'll be a shift towards talk of impeachment. But I would say the gridlock factor, I think, is even more important, and that should put pressure on the U.S. dollar.
So take some of the tailwind out of the dollar narrative. I mean, to your point, I thought September was a fascinating month because we had, sort of blowout manufacturing numbers and, 9-year high in wages, yet the dollar was unable to recapture earlier year highs in the dollar. And so, we're sitting here perplexed why that might be. And maybe it is that signal that we're sort of transitioning towards more concerns over, the level of dollars, the number of dollars the U.S. administration's had to raise.
Right. And I would also look at positioning as well. So earlier this year, everybody sort of being in the market hated the U.S. dollar. That was reflected in positioning. Everyone was long, all these other currencies. When you look at it now, it's the exact opposite. People are, the market is probably just a little too overly long U.S. dollars. And that, to me, creates sort of the value anomaly. Being contrarian, we like that. We feel better about the portfolio when we're not part of the crowd. The crowd is sort of overweight long dollar position.
Well, we are part of that crowd. We must admit, but we are nervous in that position. And things like months like September, as I just explained, make us question that view. And we do think a big trade is going to be timing that dollar, sort of the start of that dollar secular decline, and move into emerging markets. But you're there. I don't know how much conviction there is there, but you're there.
And you're right. So, it's interesting. Our highest conviction position has been Mexico. So Mexico has not traded like an EM currency this year. It's actually had a really strong performance. It weakened going into their election, but it actually is away from that. It's actually been fairly strong where we know EM markets in general have come under pressure. So, yeah, the conviction level is still very high in terms of our EM allocation. And again, it's been a bumpy ride. It's interesting because this year there hasn't been one sort of dominant theme from an emerging market standpoint. We had this broad-based global growth theme carried into Q1. EM did well. Q2 was challenged. We haven't – and one of the things, which is that we haven't talked about it, but we need to – bring about into the conversation.
Dude.
Yeah, because, it's so I think what's driving EM isn't just about EM idiosyncratic risk. So obviously, you got your Turkeys and Argentinas, but what really put pressure on EM, I think it was a few things. One of that, we talked to Fed and the new leadership, Powell. He's made some comments early on that, the Fed is the central bank to the US. We don't really care about EM. He's backpedaled. And I would remind the listeners, one of the last things Powell said in the press conference at the September FOMC meeting, and it was in the Q&A section, he says, the Fed finds EM, and I'm paraphrasing, but finds EM markets to be very important. So he's done, a 180. He's kind of come around and said, hey, we've got to keep an eye on EM. Because, it has big, huge implications for the global economy. Okay, so that's the Fed. But China, that's what put pressure on EM was China slowing earlier this year. And that was part of, kind of the broad-based growth narrative sort of diminishing, led by China. It impacted Europe. But now, you know, China's taking steps. They're stimulating their economies. Okay, so it's not going to be the 2015 version of stimulus. They don't need to do that. They need to do stimulus because, hey, the trade tensions.
It's funny, I sort of look back on the 2015 stimulus, and at the time, people were saying, this isn't huge, but it's, you know, they're stimulating. And we're sort of seeing that narrative again now, that they're stimulating. It's not of scale, but it's almost, it's very hard, perhaps it's hard to assess how much stimulus is going on, and after the event, only then can you understand how big and powerful it was, and perhaps in a year's time we'll then recognise that actually it was of size. But I understand there's a lot of motivations not to do quite so much stimulus as in the past. But you they are embarking on something.
And they are too, and it's pretty widespread. I mean, rates have come down. They've increased government spending. They've loosened some credit restrictions, so it's easier to make loans. Hey, the currency has weakened, so that's stimulative as well. But, you know, they're still doing longer-term deleveraging. You know, the pollution, maybe they have to put that on the back burner, sort of addressing that to get some better growth. But again, you know, keep in mind, it's what they're doing relative to the economic scenario getting discounted in EM.
Yeah.
And with the punishing sell-offs that we've seen in some of the emerging markets, it means a very negative scenario. And again, I think if China's stimulating, the Fed is, you know, going slow because the curve is telling them to go slow. Inflation's not out of hand. The dollar starts to adjust lower. Actually, even if the dollar just went sideways, EM is discounted such a negative scenario. By default, I think it would actually do better, and therefore it would kind of, EM currencies would strengthen versus the dollar. Maybe the dollar is going to continue to do better versus the yen and euro.
Yeah, no, like I said, I sort of buy into that thesis that the market is really pricing in too much of a negative story for emerging markets, and perhaps even a China stabilization is enough to get the assets firing. So what else are you thinking? We've talked dollar in emerging markets. What about European and UK exposure in portfolios?
Yeah, so, you know, again, so our view of Europe.
Quite a bit happening there at the moment.
Oh, it is. But okay, so we've got politics, we've got growth. I think, and I alluded to it earlier, because, you know, if you're being a global investor, you really got to look at who are the big contributors to global growth. You know, that's China and the U.S. And again, I mean, I'm not diminishing Europe as a role, but, you know, they tend to do well when the global economy is doing well.
You
know, obviously open, export-oriented economy. So, hey, if we're right in the global economy, does better. And there are some signs. And again, I would just point out, you know, all this angst about trade, and we can talk about that. But, you know, global trade is actually doing okay. There's not this huge global inventory overhang. So I think there's reasons that the global economy can actually do a little bit better in here. And then Europe's going to benefit from that environment. Obviously, the political backdrop. So, okay, we look at Italy for now. You know, and I'm not going to give you any great insight other than Italy, to me, is the poster child for when you have too much debt and not enough growth supporting that debt, and you don't have your own currency to go through an adjustment. Because if Italy was a standalone country with its own monetary policy and currency, you know, going back to the lira, it would have to adjust lower to reflect the kind of economic profile, the debt profile, that sorts of stuff, and then that would be part of the solution. Well, that's not going to happen because it's part of the euro. So something else has to unfold from that standpoint. We're not, you know, when we look at our universe of global bonds, we think the most expensive bonds are the European bond markets because we just think that growth is going to do a little bit better. Inflation is going to uptick, we think, a little bit, but that's not getting discounted in these bond markets where real yields are still very low. And the ECB is pulling back, and we'll have to see if these bond markets trade more on their underlying economic fundamentals. I'm talking particularly about French oats and German bunds and even UK UK gilts, just given in the neighborhood.
So they're sort of basically pricing in really very little inflation, and you're not expecting runaway inflation again, but you're expecting a little bit more than the market
is
currently.
Something.
But I mean, don't want to sort of corner you on Italy, but that is its own story, and I guess, you know, there is at least decent nominal numbers floating around amongst Italian assets at the moment. Does that Does that sort of have appeal as a contrarian? Maybe that sort of stacks up. Could you nibble at it, or are you on the sidelines?
We are on the sidelines because, again, what drives our investment process is less about the credit risk component, and it's more about the mispricing of inflation component of that. And again, I'm not. There could be certainly an opportunity to trade BTPs, but you know, we'll let somebody else deal with that.
Get burnt by that.
Well,
okay. And then what about? So we haven't sort of talked about Japan again.
Yeah.
A nation where there is very little inflation, and the bond market is, you know, really not being moved around by the market at all by central bank policy. I mean, how does a global investor, where that's part of your benchmark, you know, how do you manage that situation?
It's a big part of the benchmark, so you can't ignore it. But again, so we're index agnostic. So just because it's a big part of the index doesn't mean we're going to allocate our clients' money into it. So, you know, it's interesting. So Japan, yeah, it's always, we always struggle the valuation side of things when it comes to JGBs. They're just obviously a very manipulated market. I don't think they reflect enough inflation. I mean, inflation is, as we know, in Japan hasn't been an issue. It's been more of battling deflation, although their economy is actually starting to do fairly well, and you're starting to see wages move higher. Maybe they're going to finally get a little bit of an inflation. But, you know, we need to see the BOJ pull back on manipulating the bond market. I'd like to see bond markets trade more on their underlying economic fundamentals as opposed to how much the bonds are being purchased by the central bank. So, yeah, there's a lot better opportunities, we feel, to be invested in away from Japan.
And what about, finally then, about duration overall? I know it's a very sort of complex thing, given you're a global bond fund manager, but I don't know, given that the undertones that you don't expect as much inflation to come through as perhaps the market's anticipating, that it's right to have sort of fuller duration at the moment?
So I think you have to be selective on where you want your duration. Again, our approach is, as you point out, we have a global universe. You know, we can look at the developing world, the emerging world. So again, we do our real yield ranking, and what jumps out at us is that real yields are high in the developing world. They're low or negative in the developed world. So that tells us, and again, I don't think what we do is overly complicated. I distill it down to its very basics. Again, that's investing in bond markets that are discounting too much inflation expectation and avoiding those that are not pricing in enough inflation expectations. So when we look at the developing world, the emerging world, so obviously we've seen weakness in the currencies this year, and the bond market is immediately saying, wow, we're going to see more inflation as a result of that. I look at Brazil, they're top of the list in terms of the real yield. But, you know, it's interesting, actual inflation in Brazil has been pretty tame. So even in emerging economies, and you've got to be careful because I'm bucking them all together when you really shouldn't do that. But in broader terms, inflation, actual inflation, is still very well behaved in the emerging economy. We haven't seen, you've seen it move up a little bit. But you have to compare that to what's getting discounted in the bond market. And it goes back to what we've talked earlier about reality versus perception. Perception based in the sovereign bond markets is that inflation is going to move significantly higher. I think reality is going to be that, no, hey, inflation in the emerging world isn't going to move significantly higher. And that creates the opportunity. And then flip that on its head, more in the developed world, where even we've added some treasuries to the portfolios, but we're still underweight relative to the benchmark. And we can't really aggressively buy treasuries because the real yields are low and inflation expectations are still too low relative to the growth outlook in the U.S. And then that's even magnified even more in the European bond market. So think about selectively adding duration and EM, avoiding more of the developed bond markets.
Okay, Jack, thanks so much for those updates. I was going to ask you about the outcome of the Brazilian election, since you brought Brazilian assets up, but I know that one's a bit too close to call at the moment. But thanks very much for giving us that sort of tour of the globe and an update on inflation. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud or whatever platform you listen to our podcasts on. But until next time, many thanks for listening.